These parasites are way smarter than I thought.
Science. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to People, Parasites, and Plagues, a podcast aimed at delivering information about the fascinating pathogens among us from the scientists who study them. I am Kim Klonowski.
And I am David Peterson, your host for today's episode. Today, we'll explore generalism, enemy release, vacated niches, and lots of parasites.
Our guest today is Dr. Andrew Park, professor at the Odum School of Ecology and the Department of Infectious Diseases, and a member of the Center for Ecology of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Park studies emerging infectious diseases in part via the ecology and evolution of host parasite systems using mathematical and computer modeling of natural systems. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Andrew, I think if you ask most people what the field of ecology encompasses, they would likely be surprised to find infectious diseases on the list. Has this always been a part of ecology, or is this a more recent extension?
I think it's always been a part of ecology. Most of the species on the planet are parasites, and so when we begin to think about how species interact with each other, we understand that parasites should have a very central role in that network.
So, Andrew, one thing I think we should clarify here is how ecologists use the term parasite as compared with the more limited way that parasitologists use the term.
We're ultra-inclusive in ecology. Anything that lives in or on a host and has a negative fitness consequence to that host but promotes its own fitness would be considered a parasite. So we would look at worms, helminths, protozoa, viruses, fungi.
How about a developing fetus?
Why not? I mean, it's a little complicated in terms of the genetic similarity to the mother, but yeah, it's. I'm sure that's partly why the immune system is doing some interesting things during pregnancy.
That is true. That is true. Your research isn't like typical bench research, so our listeners might need to better understand how you approach scientific questions. Does your research involve developing a hypothesis, then testing it by looking at data or case studies, or do you mine some cases, develop a hypothesis in a set of cases, and then test it on a broader set of cases?
That's a great question. My background was very much case study oriented, and I still love that and see the value in that. The kinds of questions I'm interested in now are better accessed by looking at lots of case studies simultaneously. Sometimes that starts with a clear hypothesis and a linear progression, just like we would love all our science to do. But other times it's much more iterative along the lines you're getting at, where look at some data, get some inspiration, hone your question, and then go through towards that hypothesis testing step.
So the students that come in your lab that are doing this type of research, how difficult is it for them to kind of develop that approach, that kind of mindset of testing hypotheses?
I think this approach is growing in ecology, and that helps because students come in these days with already some experience of having read that work. So when I was getting involved in this research, it was pretty new and there wasn't an awful lot to go back on. There are some great scientists who've been doing this for several decades, but it's not widespread. So that's perhaps the biggest challenge for the students is the literature that's out there is relatively narrow compared to other scientific approaches.
So you've worked on really a staggering variety of parasites, from viruses to bacteria to parasites as defined by parasitologists. Do the same tools work across all these pathogens?
Yes, I think so. Often you might collect slightly different data on the parasite. So for example, your favorite protozoa, we might be very interested in the intensity of infections within individual animals, but we might not collect those data routinely for viruses, for example. In terms of the questions, yeah, I think it's actually important to understand why the same question might have a different answer in a virus group compared to bacteria or helminths. And that's one of the research thrusts that I'm really interested in.
One topic of your research that's fascinating is the enemy release hypothesis. Can you talk to us and describe that maybe for our listeners and talk about how this relates to invasive species?
Yeah, so I'm sure we all have experienced some invasive species, whether it's kudzu or an animal that's taking over a local area. One of the reasons that species are so successful when they invade is that they're leaving behind some of their natural enemies. That includes parasites, but it would also be perhaps predators or specialized parasitoids. So we want to understand the role in which the loss of parasites as animals move into an invasive range plays in their ability to outcompete and establish themselves in these new invaded ranges.
So let's get back to kudzu, because I think that's one that most people can understand. Can you, number one, describe for our listeners who may not be in the South, maybe just the basics of kudzu and how it's everywhere here, and maybe just kind of define how what's happened with that organism or that plant?
I might not do a great job. As you can tell from my accent, I'm not from the southeast of the United States.
Correct.
My first experience was seeing objects shaped like cars, but were literally just vines, leaves. And so this is an invasive plant that will grow up and on other living trees and plants, will drag them down and just take over forested plots in an alarmingly short space of time. So a very successful invasive species.
Right. Not from the Americas at all.
Not from the Americas at all.
Right. I can't remember its origin. Was it?
I wanted to say Asia.
Japan. Yeah.
So as far as enemy release hypothesis goes, let's switch from kudzu to a parasite. Do you have examples there?
Some of the earliest work on enemy release was really aimed at quantifying the loss of parasites, and has been shown that between approximately 20 to maybe 70 or 80% of parasites are often lost as animals move into the invasive range. They just don't bring their parasites with them.
So are there examples where loss has led to extinction? So like if something comes in and drives something else out, has that had extreme consequences?
I don't know too much about that. I would say we measure extinction more locally. We think of local extirpation.
Right.
That's for sure happened and is happening to some extent. I can tell you that some of our studies have shown that sometimes when animals invade, they lose most of their parasites. What they keep are often their specialist parasites. And that creates a special problem for certain species in that invaded range. First of all, the related species to that invasive host were already likely to suffer the consequences of that invasion because of things like competition.
Right.
There's now this extra effect where the only parasites that the invasive animals brought with them are going to spill over to related host species because it's a specialist parasite. So we think that's going to be a double whammy, essentially.
Maybe somewhat related, but kind of on the flip side of this, you had a publication recently that, and I thought the title was just so cool, The Ghost of Hosts Past, Impacts of Host Extinction on Parasite Specificity. So instead of hosts moving and leaving their parasites behind, the hosts disappear, and what happens to the parasites then?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, we have to be clear about how to define specialism and generalism. Someone who's interested in human public health would just ask the question, do the hosts include humans, yes or no? Some people would count the number of hosts that a parasite has. What we're more interested in is thinking about the relatedness of the hosts that a parasite uses, because that gives us a sense of how it might increase its host range, how it might add new species if it's able to jump the species barrier. So in that study, we were interested in understanding historic extinctions and how that might have changed the playing field in terms of the advantages and disadvantages of specializing. But also, it's left a legacy where, as we look at contemporary parasites now and try to understand their specificity, we need to pay attention to the fact that some host groups, some clades, have actually lost a lot of species. And so we might be misassessing what the potential of a parasite is to acquire new hosts just because it's already experienced a lot of host extinctions.
So would you say in general, most of these parasites are looking to expand their hosts?
That's a great question. I mean, that comes to the heart of what we do in our lab, where we really want to understand the costs and benefits of being a specialist or a generalist. I always think of two well-known viruses in this case. One would be measles, which is a human specialist. The other would be rabies, which is a mammal generalist, just infecting anything, so essentially. And when you see that in nature, it's very appealing to ask the question, why isn't everything a specialist or why isn't everything a generalist? And that comes out of some rather cryptic costs and benefits.
I like your example of measles and rabies. That one's a very obvious one. And it actually helps us as immunologists and vaccinologists when we have something that's limited to a specific host to be able to use vaccines and things to eliminate that if it's detrimental to the host. But what about the case of influenza viruses? So you have influenza A viruses, which I think are more generalists, right? So they can go into lots of different species, including things like whales and birds and lots of things. But influenza B, I believe, is pretty limited to humans.
Yeah. So the understanding the host range of a parasite, a virus like influenza A or B, has to include opportunity for infection. I think in the modern world, there's a lot of interspecies contacts that are being made. So opportunity probably isn't the barrier that it might have been historically. And that shines a light on these other barriers and bridges to jumping the species barrier. And I think that these costs and benefits become really important. So as evolutionary ecologists, we're interested in the fitness of species. We measure the fitness of viruses through this R number that's become a little bit more in the literature with COVID, I think. So we don't often understand how fitness is distributed among hosts of a parasite. So it might be acquiring a host, meaning it's capable of infecting it, but we don't know whether that's going to be a species that can maintain a virus or not. I think that some of this comes down to very careful, almost forensic analysis of the infection. That's some of the work we also do in our lab with influenza, funnily enough, where we're interested in different genotypes of the virus, how that allows them to infect cells and spread through a tissue system, but also how it is responding to immune defenses as well. So these very small scale biological phenomena cascade up and ultimately determine the ability of an infection to happen at the individual host level, and then the spread at that population level as well. So I think that we really need to be thinking across biological scales to properly understand what's limiting host range.
So you mentioned the R value, which is, am I correct in saying that's kind of defined as the number of people or animals or hosts that will be infected from an infected host?
That's right.
And what's the range of that for some common parasites that people may know about?
Yeah, it's a great question. A critical number is to exceed one. So it's important that one host is causing more than one infection so that that can grow and cause an epidemic, for example. Typically, R numbers are not particularly high. Parasites tend to evolve efficient transmission, so they need to think as well essentially about the supply of susceptible animals into the population and not burn through populations causing extinctions of themselves. I would say of the pathogens we've discussed, maybe measles has a rather high R number, getting up to about 20 in an unvaccinated population. That's why we have to be so careful with adhering to immunization campaigns, essentially, to keep that proportion of immunized children high. So yeah, maybe between about just above one to up to about 20 would be fairly typical values.
And where would things like influenza or COVID, do you know, kind of fall on that scale, just for our listeners?
Yeah, probably in the 2 to 3 category, really not much higher than one. There's a lot of attack and defense going on in that interaction between the host and the parasite that limits transmission, and I think that regulates the R number.
So, Andrew, it seems to me that it could be really challenging to get a good measure of R naught, say, when you're in the middle of a pandemic like we have been recently, when you have implementation of public health measures and then you have vaccines come in or treatments? How do you account for all those things?
That's a great question. I think that one of the promising approaches when you have those kinds of data, so maybe you have something like an epidemic curve and you're aware of some of the changes that have been going on in that host population. Maybe there's been isolation, but it didn't happen until the second month, for example, or a vaccine has been rolled out. You can use model-based inference. So you can construct mathematical models that describe the transmission. And essentially what you'd be doing is matching the output of those models to data that you're able to get in order to make a good estimate of what the underlying numbers or parameters are. And that would allow you to get an estimate of the R0 or the R number.
I think one of the earliest estimates of R0 that they had for COVID was based off of, correct me if I'm wrong, there were people on a ship that were kind of isolated that started coming down with COVID, and they were able to come up with a pretty quick R0 based on this kind of extreme, if you will, of people being isolated.
Seems very artificial.
Very, very artificial. But I mean, I guess you could say, you know, if you have people moving freely around and they're interacting, how transmissible is it?
I think back in my home country in the UK, some of the early estimates came from boarding schools for a very similar reason.
Ah.
You've got a contained population, which gives you a clean way, essentially, of trying to estimate some numbers when you don't have all of that
right
movement in and out of the population.
And I imagine a very simple mathematical formula, probably one that I could understand.
Absolutely.
Versus one that is overlaid with all the variables that are in the real world.
You know, you almost couldn't set up a better experiment than to take a bunch of susceptibles and put them in a controlled, contained environment and then watch how a pathogen spreads. All the conspiracy theorists are going to go nuts now.
I'm sure. So, Andrew, I also understand that you're very interested in what's referred to as the vacated niche hypothesis. Can you start by telling our listeners what you mean by that?
Yes. And apologies in advance if I start saying vacated niche hypothesis, because I can't stop myself. There are a couple of interesting anecdotal examples. One is in human populations. We saw a recent emergence of monkeypox virus closely related to smallpox virus. So there's an understanding that we eradicated smallpox in the late 1970s. We ceased immunizing individuals against it. And so as those individuals age out of the population, and because we don't have smallpox virus anymore, it's created space for a related virus to potentially jump in to that population. And so there's some speculation that monkeypox has occupied that vacated niche of smallpox. In other animals as well, we've eradicated rinderpest, a morbillivirus, and we've seen increased cases in those animals of something called petit peste ruminant, which is like a very related morbillivirus. So again, there are these anecdotal examples that there are parasites out there waiting to jump into a host population, but they need the space. They need the other one, the close relative, to get out. And so as we begin to eradicate pathogens more and more, which I think is very feasible, we need to be aware that there could be something else waiting in the wings, and we could perhaps begin to anticipate what that's going to be.
So it's almost like the original virus was benefiting from the host's immune response to keep potential competitor parasites away.
Yeah, I think it was accepting that cost in order to be able to exploit the host itself.
These parasites are way smarter than I thought.
Well, what we've been doing is we've been looking across most terrestrial mammals, all of their parasites, be they viruses or some other taxonomic group. And we're finding a lot of evidence for this vacated niche idea. So we use invasive animals as a study system because we know that they do leave behind a large number of their parasites when they move to a new range. Then we can ask the question, which parasites did they lose and which parasites did they acquire? And when we do that in a statistically robust way, we begin to find great evidence that there's a lot of swapping out of parasites that are close relatives to each other. And actually, viruses is maybe not the most compelling group, even though that's where I think the anecdotal case studies have come from. So if we're seeing it in viruses, I think for sure it's happening perhaps undetected across the parasite world more generally.
Right. And I think we need to remind our listeners, when we talk about some of these organisms, we talk about them very broadly, but there's lots of different related organisms that we don't talk about like we do malaria and some of the kind of big, well-known organisms. So there is a lot of ability for this kind of swapping, this vacated niche, with some related organisms that people maybe have never even heard of.
Exactly. I think what I'm interested most in using this kind of research for is to be able to anticipate. So we're getting a much better understanding, for example, of how climate change and land use change will redistribute animals around the planet. We know that as that happens, they're going to lose a lot of parasites, but they're also going to start acquiring other ones as well. And that can create very new dynamics. So animals can suddenly play, for example, a more important role as a zoonotic risk because they've maybe lost a parasite, but they've picked something up that's of greater risk to humans. They've moved into an area where they may have more contact with humans. So there's definitely an angle where we can think about our own health, but I'm more interested in just understanding how parasites will redistribute themselves under this time, this Anthropocene that we're living in, where the planet's changing so dramatically.
So on the topic of climate change, you had a paper where you were looking at, I believe it was vector-transmitted diseases and how changes in climate are changing vector species and how this could impact disease transmission. So what more do we have to worry about from planting?
Well, I think the more we're learning, the more prepared we are. And so I see it more as an opportunity than something to be concerned about. I believe that in that system, there was something like 50 different vector species that could transmit this virus. What we observed was as temperature swings in the year were changing, which we know is a feature we'll see more of in the future, entire communities of these vector species were changing. So it wasn't just we were losing one species here and picking up a species there. The entire community is likely to change. In that particular example, communities are changing between a set of species that are very poor at transmitting the virus to a set of species that are very good at transmitting the virus. So it's just something to be aware of, that small changes in temperature, for example, can cause entire communities to switch out, so the parasite may have new, improved opportunities for transmission.
And I think we tend to, as humans, think about this in terms of ourselves, right? Like, and I am clearly guilty of that by some of the questions that I've been asking today, like what's it doing to us and our health and things. But when we talk about this, it's also affecting animals and changing things like pollination and lots of things that affect us agriculturally and other animal populations that can have other consequences, you know, not just on us directly.
Absolutely. Food security is maybe a good example where pathogens are going to affect meat production, dairy production, plant-based foods. All of that is likely to be changing quite dramatically in the coming years. So I think we need to be mindful of some of these other ecosystem services that we might talk about, like pollination, and how that can be regulated even by these pathogens and parasites.
So Andrew, we have learned that you like to box. This is fitness?
Yes. As someone whose time gets used up quite effectively in my job, I would say that I needed a very efficient way of exercising, and this is it for me. 45 minutes training with boxers is plenty.
So I have to admit, I've taken a few boxing classes. Actually, my sister does it regularly, and when I visit her, she dragged me to the boxing class. And I was surprised at how heavy the gloves got. after 45 minutes to an hour, and also how complicated it seemed to be, because you have to think about your stance and moving your feet and moving your hands. And after all that, I tended to always just kind of dodge into punches instead of avoiding.
The workout for you was in the preparation.
So I had poor fitness when it came to boxing. But on the subject of fitness and boxing, we have one final question. If you had to compare a parasite to a boxer, which parasite would be the greatest of all time?
Well, you've got to move like a butterfly, sting like a bee. So I would want one that can jump around between species and have a big impact once it gets there. And we've got to have great respect for rabies virus in that case.
And with rabies, what's also interesting is it can do a lot with just a few virions.
Exactly. It packs a lot of punch.
Packs a lot of punch.
And it's a generalist.
And a generalist. Our guest today is Dr. Andrew Park, professor at the Odom School of Ecology and the Department of Infectious Diseases, and a member of the Center for Ecology of Infectious Diseases. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Links to additional information about Dr. Park's research can be found on our Instagram account at PPPPodcastUGA.
Thank you for tuning in today. Please rate the podcast. If you have any questions or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us via email at ppp@uga.edu. This podcast is brought to you by the Faculty of Infectious Diseases and the Grady College of Journalism at the University of Georgia. It is supported by the University of Georgia through the Office of Research, the UGA Graduate School, and the College of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks to the New Media Institute at Grady for use of their Studio Not Found podcast facilities, and a special thanks to our production assistant, Sid Wigand, for research, editing, scheduling, and keeping us on track.